I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is actress, writer, neuroscientist, and founder of GrokNation.com, Mayim Bialik. And now join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Mayim Bialik. I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs here, and I'm so thrilled to welcome all of you to an evening with Mayim Bialik tonight. She's here to celebrate her wonderful new book, Girling Up, How to Be Strong, Smart, and Spectacular. The book was just announced number one New York Times bestseller, so let's keep it there. I'm sure you all know, after a successful childhood acting career that included her role in the film Beaches, playing Bette Midler's character as a girl, and starring in the NBC sitcom Blossom from 1991 to 1994, Mayim left the spotlight to attend college and went on to complete her PhD in neuroscience. She returned to TV in 2010 as Amy Farrah Fowler on the hit comedy The Big Bang Theory, and has received four Emmy nominations for her work on the show. She's now written her first book for young readers, an empowering guidebook for teens addressing all the aspects of growing from a girl to a woman, Girling Up. Please join me to welcome Mayim Bialik to the JCC. Welcome, Mayim.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for coming. So we have a lot to talk about, and I want to get to a lot, but I want to start with this amazing new book, number one New York Times bestseller.
That's right. We just found out today.
So congratulations
Thank
on that
you.
Achievement. And I'm wondering if you can tell us in your quick explanation of what this book is and why and how it came to be.
Well, anyone who knows me knows that I never give quick explanations of anything. But I can make a good college try. So I wrote this book for 10 to 18-year-old girls, or anyone who ever has been a 10 to 18-year-old girl, or anyone who cares about any person who's ever been in that age range. And what I did was... I was not inspired to write this book. I was asked to write this book after Jill Santopolo at Penguin read an article I wrote for my website, Grok Nation, about being a late bloomer and playing one on TV. And she liked the way I spoke about being a late bloomer without it being like political or religious. And she said, would you like to write a book like that for girls about, you know, dating and sex and things like that? And I said, yes, but can I also write about the other aspects of being female besides just, you know, sex and dating? So from a scientific perspective, that's what I did. I kind of go through everything from, you know, puberty and hormones to how the brain learns, how our body grows, how stress affects our body. Yes, how we form intimate relationships with friends and with lovers, how to make an impact in the world. And one of my favorite chapters, how to cope with difficult things. And I talk very personally about, you know, some of the challenges I've had. That was not a short explanation, but it was an explanation.
And I'm curious about your choice of strong, smart, and spectacular.
Right. Why didn't I choose sassy, sexy, and sweet? We chose those words very, very specifically. You know, one thing I'm very careful about in general, and I had a YouTube video that people seem to watch a lot recently about that. I'm very careful with language, and we wanted to be very careful with language. You know, when I think about what I wish for myself, what I would wish for girls in this age range, those three characteristics really sum up, you know, notions of strength, which can be emotional resilience, as well as physical strength, intelligence, and this sort of, you know, notion of eccentricity and individuality, which we use the word spectacular to describe. And I do speak about, you know, the expectations of women and girls, you know, to be sweet, saucy, and sexy in the book, and also elsewhere. But yeah, we chose those for those reasons.
And while writing this book, was there anything that you were surprised to learn or discover? What was sort of the most, part of it?
You know, that like I'm 41 years old and I'm still shy about talking about sex. I mean, obviously there are arenas where I'm not uncomfortable or, you know, where I'm more comfortable. But yeah, writing about it was hard because I was such a late bloomer. And when you're writing a book for an age range like 10 to 18, you really have to, you know, you have to favor the younger side. I've been asked some specific questions. You know, why didn't you include discussions of how young's the youngest person here, by the way? It would help to know.
Do we have anyone under 12?
There's a 12-year-old. Is she with an adult that knows her? Okay, good. No, I prepare for an education tonight, young lady. No, but I've been asked, you know, specific things like, why didn't you cover this very, very heavy topic? Or why didn't you cover more complicated aspect, I'm being delicate, more complicated aspects of lack of consent and things like that. And I said, you know, I really wanted to err on the side of making it really palatable, you know, for the younger set that might be reading this. And, you know, the way I was at 10 is the way not a lot of girls are at 10. You know, girls are different now, and of course, not all girls are different. I'm sure there are still, you know, girls who at 14 sleep with stuffed animals like I did, possibly also at 16 and maybe also at 41. But I think I really wanted to kind of strike that balance. Yeah.
So when I was in the age range, my mom gave me the What's Happening to My Body book for girls, and I went and I kind of read it alone, and I was like, I got this. I understand. And when I was reading your book, I thought, oh, okay, this is like What's Happening plus, which was really helpful. And I'm wondering, did you have a similar book when you were that in that age range that you went turned
I
to?
Had, my mother just said no. No. let's see. The first book that I saw that I wish that we had was actually in Rebecca. Where are you? I can't see you.
Rebecca.
Cousin Rebecca. Sorry, totally embarrassing you. I was in Rebecca's home, and it was a really cool book, and it was like, you know those like illustrations that are done with like torn paper kind of illustrations? Like they're kind of, you know, and it was all these different animals, like here's two chickens, and you know, here's an egg, and I was like, oh, that's good. I was like well into maybe my teens, possibly early 20s, when I found this in their bookshelf, And I said to Rebecca's mom, to my aunt, I was like, what's this book? And she's like, didn't your mother show you this book? I said, no, we had no such book in the Bialik house. I had classes in school, which I didn't understand. And because I was such a late bloomer, honestly, you know, I think my mother feels like I'm, you know, publicly shaming her for not having the sex talk with me when I was 10. But what it really was that I was such a late bloomer that I think she was kind of relieved. She came from a very religious home, very conservative home. And I think she was relieved that I was showing no signs of becoming a woman until I was like 16. So she didn't have to talk about it. I didn't have to talk about it. You know, on the show Blossom buys feminine products.
Oh, I know.
Yes. And that was a healthy 3 or 4 years before I did that in real life.
So
true story.
So was there... What was it like to perform through things that you were also going through?
I should have gotten an Emmy then, if you ask me. I'm just kidding. What was it? I mean, you know, I knew what tampons were, and I knew, you know, the cultural expectations that it's embarrassing. And also, you know, the Blossom character was raised without a mother in the home. So, you know, it was more kind of about that. And it wasn't like there was like a lot of detail to it. It was more kind of playing the comedy of it. But yeah, I had my first kiss on television. You know, it's really weird. So yeah, there were a lot of, but I was kind of used to that. And, you know, I was used to being kind of the last one to get jokes. I was used to being the last one in my group to, you know, hit all sorts of, you know, honestly arbitrary kind of, you know, milestones in terms of dating. Again, think about that 12-year-old. So yeah, I was kind of used to that. And, you know, there were a lot of things about me that that I, you know, tried to appreciate and did appreciate about being different. And, you know, that was okay too. And, you know, something also that we didn't want to overemphasize in the book is that it's not the right way to be a late bloomer. And, you know, after I wrote this kind of very heartfelt section about, you know, what it was like to be a late bloomer and how much people teased me and, like, I did get breasts eventually, even though they said I wouldn't. You know, Jill said to me, you know, I really think we need to add a section about how it's also okay to not be a late bloomer. And I think that kind of, you know, it sets the tone for kind of the whole book that, you know, and this is my third book I've written, and my first book was about my experience parenting, and I literally said in the foreword, I don't know how you should parent. I know how I parent, and I wrote a book about it. And my second book was a vegan family cookbook, and I said, I don't know how you should eat. This is how I eat, and if you're interested, buy my book or don't. And I feel like that's kind of what we wanted to do with Girling Up. Like, I don't know how you should grow up. I can explain to you physiologically what's happening. I can explain to you psychologically, and I know enough about kind of sociology and a little bit about anthropology to kind of talk about how other cultures experience, you know, all of these aspects of girling up. But we didn't want it to be like, I'm a late bloomer and my life is perfect, and, you know, cause it's not. But I do think it's important to drive this, you know, kind of point home that, you don't need to live with someone to know what it's like to live with someone. You don't need to kiss lots of people to know how to kiss. I mean, obviously there's like a learning curve, but it can be pretty steep, you know? No, but I think like that's something that I used to hear a lot, you know, like, well, you need to be physically intimate with someone so that you know how to be physically intimate. And the fact is, sure, there are advantages and disadvantages to both ways, but we didn't want to present a book where I was sounding like a scolding mom. Like, you know, if you have a scolding mom, you don't need another.
And what advice would you give your 12-year-old Mayim? From this book or otherwise?
Well, I think, yeah. I think the advice that I would give 12-year-old me, or really any of the ages that this book is sort of aimed at, you know, for those of us who are different, I talk a lot about being different in the book. I think that it would have been nice to know that I'm probably always going to be different, and that that's going to become less and less painful. And I think that I had this notion when I was younger and I felt different and I was different and everyone said that I was different and I knew it. I think I had this notion of like, oh, well, one day I'll be like them and I won't feel so different and I'll blend in and, you know, all the cute boys will like me and my body will be perfect. Like, cause that's going to happen one day. But, I think I would have liked to know, and I do talk about this in the book. Sometimes you're just different, but you meet more people like you. You meet more like-minded people as you get older and as people you're interested in having relationships with mature, you know, as boys mature, if you're interested in boys, you know, as they mature, things do get easier. But there's always going to be a sense that we're all very, very unique and there's not a singular experience and that will get less painful and it will be, you know, a cause for less angst or angst. I think my mom was trying to start a round of applause. Mom.
So that's pretty fascinating for me to hear you describe this very, I mean, these are common feelings that I think probably most people feel at some point, at least that also was my experience. However, I was not the star of a television show that was hugely successful and popular. And so I'm right now thinking about having this huge sort of outward success and still having those.
Yeah. So that didn't help.
Okay.
Because I don't know, like a lot of kids are mean, you know, like that's a thing. And I was in a very academically geared junior high and high school program where really the only thing that mattered was literally was your grades. It was not seen as an asset that in any way I was garnering more attention. I know my mother wants to shout out, they were jealous of you. I mean, I think there definitely was an aspect with a lot of the females, you know, that there was a lot of like that, but like boys didn't like me, girls weren't fond of, like that wasn't good. But I think, you know, this is another point that I love to make. You know, I'm known for being like publicly vulnerable, let's just have a vulnerable moment. So a lot of times when I'm interviewed, people say like, you know, you're so confident. How can I be as confident as you? Or like, you know, you've done so much and how can I get my daughter to do that? And like, you know, people don't realize I'm not really comfortable with a lot of what I do, but it is what I do. And I don't mean that I'm uncomfortable. I mean that my sense of like existence in the universe is one of, you know, kind of discomfort. I'm an anxious person. I've talked very publicly about mental health struggles. You know, I'm a big advocate of therapy. I work on myself literally all the time. And, you know, the notion that my public life is very strong, you know, and like my Instagram followers make, you know, the people that have to, you know, give me a thumbs up for having lots of followers happy, like it makes them happy. But that doesn't mean that I'm not like a human being. And that I don't feel insecure. Like, I go down the rabbit hole of other people's Instagram accounts who I don't even know and, like, end up weeping in my bed. Like, that's, like, a thing. Like, I cannot be the only... That's, like, other
no,
people
I think
do
we
this,
all,
right?
Okay. We all yeah. okay. do that. Most of us, yeah. Yeah,
yeah so, like that. That's, like, I don't... You know, people assume, like, ooh, you're so confident. And I'm actually, like, I'm opinionated and I'm feisty. But that doesn't always translate, you know, to being, like, confident. And there are times when I will, you know, absolutely open my mouth and say something. But in general, when it comes to, like, body image or, like, comparing myself to other, like, I'm, you know, I experience all those things as a human being. I'm not above that. And, you know, another thing, the reason I talk so openly about mental health is that no one is immune from that. There's no amount of money that you can make. There's no amount of things you can acquire that make you immune, you know, to the stresses of life and the genetic possibility that many of us will struggle with things. So I think that's an important point, and I appreciate that people, you know, may feel inspired by me or by my videos, but, like, everything, like, you know, a lot of things are hard for me just because, like, that's who I am, and you don't always get to see that. But part of why I make these YouTube videos is we're trying to open that up in ways that are productive.
That's true.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mom.
My mother has never been... Have you ever been to a talk of mine? Like, once, maybe? She doesn't usually come to things, so this is very, very special to have her here. Oh, she's going to... I'm going to get, like, 7 texts later. Why did you say that?
She's texting you right now. So, one thing I also want... Or another thing I want to talk about is the way that you move in and out of the public eye. You were in it.
I'm, like, darting in and out like an electric eel.
Iconic, but in these... In these very iconic, I mean, these roles that you're in that are standing the test of time and will be very emblematic of a certain time and place in our society. And you come in, and then you step away, and you, I'm thinking about when you left and went to college and
Did
got your
PhD. Did my ex-boyfriend tell you to ask this question?
No.
I'm like, I'm in, I'm out.
Yeah, but...
I get close, I pull away.
That decision to step back in, and it seems like... Like, for me, I would think that the ego is intoxicating, and for you, it doesn't feel that way. It feels like
no.
It's a conscious, I'm doing this, and
Correct.
Now I'm not.
I'm allergic to my ego. Yeah, so I was a child, teenage actor, and I left the industry when I was 19 for a total of 12 years, and I did. I got my undergraduate degree and my doctorate as well, and I had 2 children. That happened too. So I came out of grad school with a PhD and a toddler and a newborn. I had to pay extra for that, you know. They really hike up the tuition. And I returned to acting sort of by accident, and it was not because I missed being famous. It was not because I missed making a stupid amount of money, which, you know, really everyone in our industry does. I mean, that's just, you know, that's like a thing. I mean, don't believe everything you read on the internet, but that is a thing, that we do make a lot of money for playing dress-up, effectively. But no, the fame was never exciting to me, and that was part of why I left at 19, and it's part of why I'm, you know, hesitant now, and why I don't engage in a lot of the things that other, you know, celebrities do. Or, you know, that's the reason why when I started a website, which I did about 2 years ago, you know, I didn't start a celebrity lifestyle site, because my... My lifestyle is such that when I saw the price tag on this outfit, I texted my stylist and said, just kidding, I don't want that outfit, it's too expensive. But yeah, I started a site for people who collect thoughts and not things, and it's a literary site, and it's an analytical kind of thing. So yeah, the fame part is very scary to me. I don't like that seductiveness. I don't find it particularly seductive, but people really get swallowed up by it, and I feel a lot more, I mean... New York City is a place where I kind of feel like me, but the next place that I feel like me is like a place like San Francisco, because in LA it doesn't feel like this. It really does feel like everything's about, you know, fame and ego. And honestly, coming from a world of academia, that's also a very highly ego-based field, especially as a minority, as a woman. You're in a very predominantly male, you know, set of classes and faculty and all of that, and there's a lot of ego there.
You're listening to actress, writer, neuroscientist, and founder of GrokNation.com, Mayim Bialik, whose new book is Girling Up, How to Be Strong, Smart, and Spectacular, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
You know, also I'm what we call an unadorned feminist, you know, so I'm not really big on like presentation and those kind of things just don't sit well with me. And I write a lot for my website, and I used to write for a Jewish website, Kfeller, you know, about sort of the expectations in particular on women and the red carpet. Like, you know, awards season is very exciting, you know, obviously, and being nominated is like, it's crazy and it's really flattering. You know, but the thing that I dread most is like fittings and dresses and make and like having to sit in a chair for 2 hours while they, you know, put all this stuff. I should also say this is my real hair. And I love speaking at places like JCC's and Jewish Federations because I don't have to be ashamed of my Jufro here. It's just in all its glory, just every which direction. I got cowlicks for every day of the week.
Have you developed some coping techniques and mechanisms for when you're going through those high stress?
Scotch, high quality scotch.
Excellent.
Well, a little bit. No. honestly, like I have a really solid therapist who helps me, you know, navigate a lot of those particularities surrounding it. You know, I'm a feminist who does like to be partnered. Typically with a male. And I do, you know, I've been divorced for many years, but I was in a long-term relationship and found a lot of comfort having someone who knew me really well with me at events, because that does help. It's not the same taking a girlfriend, nothing against women or girlfriends, but there's just something different, you know. So that's hard. Like being single and doing that stuff is kind of crummy buttons. But I have a very supportive group of women around me, my publicist, Heather, and my manager, Tiffany. So it's nice to know I always have that kind of support. I always do try and wear a Jewish star or hide one, you know, somewhere. And that gives me a sense of, you know, honestly, like safety and kind of humility. I usually have a vegan Thai iced tea before a red carpet event. A little sugar and caffeine never hurt to kind of, you know, power you through. And honestly, our cast is very close, and so whenever we have events where we get to be together, that feels good. I'm close with Melissa Rauch and Simon Helberg in particular. Yes, they happen to be the Jewish cast members, but everyone's thinking that. They're like, but no, I'm close. But it's, you know, so it's always nice also. But the last two times I was nominated for Emmys, I was the only one nominated and our show wasn't nominated. So I was like alone, which is, you know, it's different, especially if you have social anxiety, which I do. And that looks like a lot of different things. So that can be not pleasant.
The scotch comes in.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to sit up here and like advocate for drinking alcohol to make yourself feel better socially. However, it has worked for thousands of years. And so I do not have a drinking problem. I mean, that's honestly, that is something I speak about. I speak about it in the book. You know, like alcohol is absolutely, you know, a social lubricant and one that should be used, you know, especially with caution. I mean, seriously, especially in those developing years. And I do make everything about science somehow, and I just did.
Speaking of your values.
Yes.
I want to spend some time talking about Judaism and your relationship to it and your values. You get a lot of press for both. And I'm wondering...
I'm like God's best publicist.
You right are now. God's best publicist. So I was trying to think about, okay, who else is kind of that the famous and religious, and really the only other person I immediately thought about was Stephen Colbert, who we were talking about.
Correct.
Not Jewish, just in case anyone was confused. He's Catholic. But I'm wondering, are there others? Do you have like a secret club?
So, no, it's funny you mention that. So there is a little bit of a secret club. I mean, it's not so secret because I'm going to tell you all about it now. So David Sachs is someone who was a Simpsons writer, executive producer, won Emmy for that. He became religious kind of after that, but he's very observant. And... I won't name him by name, but one of our executive producers on our show, we actually learned with David. We did like chavrusa, like a, you know, like proper Jewish learning I think for 2 years we did that. And honestly, this person, well, his name's Eric, our producer, Eric. He's a really comforting, you know, presence, because we often will meet and hang out and like talk religion and things like that. And we're on a very similar kind of spiritual derech, as it were, path. You know, there are not really actors who are observant. I mean, I know somebody's gonna be like, there was a guy on CSI. Like, it's true. There was like one guy that I heard of. But in terms of the circles that I know, there are writers. There are other writers who are from observant. But yeah, there's not that many of us. And sometimes I do kind of connect more with like religious Christians, you know, in that sense, in the sense of like being, you know, kind of lone wolves as religious people. But I don't think it's just the industry. Like, I think in general, you know, a lot of traditional patriarchal religion has fallen, I don't want to say out of favor, but there are a lot of things I'm unhappy about the patriarchy and how it's presented in Judeo-Christianity. So, you know, it's not like I'm, you know, I don't wave the flag of orthodoxy, like, this is the best way to be Jewish. And, you know, there are a lot of different ways. And, you know, I think ultimately I think I'm in the right audience to say I'm a spiritual person. Like in LA, that means like I like yoga. But I think, I think the Northern California understanding of spirituality is about, you know, a connection with something that gives your life meaning and purpose that may not be perfectly structured, you know, around a patriarchal, you know, religion like that. And I do have, you know, a lot of that too. I'm like a crunchy granola hippy dippy person. Don't let my $600 outfit fool you. Right? You wouldn't spend that either. I was like, no. No. Are we having fun, Jordan?
We are having so much fun. Are you guys having fun? Great. So when you're, as you're moving through life as a religious, spiritual, not yoga, yes, but spiritual person, and wondering how do you make the decisions about being observant and flexible? I mean, do you kind of hold up each piece of prescribed religious tradition and assess it as to whether it applies to you or not? Or
That's a really big question. Do you mean in terms of my lifestyle or just in general? Like, how do I decide that I don't wear pants outside the house, but like whatever, like things like that?
I think, yeah, that or bigger.
Yeah, I mean, I formally learned. I did a minor in Hebrew and Jewish studies in college, and that was sort of the beginning of, you know, starting to study more of like the formal structure of Judaism in terms of Jewish history and sociology. And then after I had my first son, I actually signed up for Partners in Torah, which is a free program where you're matched with a partner, usually across the country. They're usually in New York. And you, honestly, it's free, and you can study anything you want. And I wanted to study, well, what I did was when I was matched with this woman, her name's Allison Josephs, and she actually goes by Jew in the City online. She has an online presence. And anyway, we were matched together, and I basically said to her, these are all of the negative things that I think about Judaism. I don't want you to disprove them. I want you to explain where those stereotypes come from and, you know, kind of start explaining around them so I can understand more about traditional Judaism. And so we studied a lot about women's issues. I actually studied with a Kala teacher, with a bride instructor, a very progressive one before I got married. So, yeah, I started formally learning, and that opened up a lot for me and also helped me understand the structure of halacha, the places where there are loopholes in Jewish law and why they're there. And it gave me a greater appreciation for, you know, like Judaism in a historical context, which for me was really important for deciding what I, you know, wanted to observe or not. But for me, like, God is separate from that. You know, the physics is separate from that. You know, my God is the God of the tides and physics and the reason we don't fly off the planet and why, you know, if I turn this over, the water's going to spill on the floor. Like, I have absolute certainty that if I turn that glass upside down, the water's going to fall on the floor. And so if you have that certainty and you don't believe in God, that's fine. But I believe we believe in the same thing. We believe that there are forces in the universe that, yeah, we can explain them, but we don't know their origins, and they're completely infinite. They're arbitrary in terms of what we call them. You know, like the number eight is only the number eight because we call it the number eight, but the concept of eight exists without name and without, you know, that's math just is. So for me, like, that's where my religious faith is. And that's very, I find a tremendous source of comfort in ritual. And if you don't like ritual, yeah, halachic Judaism is not for you, because there's a lot of ritual. And you know, honestly, if you have, if you do, and I'm not speaking lightly about this, if you have a personality that tends to obsessions and compulsions, there are a lot of things, honestly, in traditional Judaism that give you places to bind anxiety that way. And there's actually some really interesting research about hormones and Orthodox women and OCD diagnoses, and it's very, very interesting research. A lot of it's out of UCLA. But anyway, those things are, they bring me comfort and they give me routine. I love the Jewish calendar. I love that it's tied to the seasons, even in this modern time. And you know, I'm ethnically Eastern European, and I'm a mutt. I'm a conglomeration of Poland and of Hungary and of like either Ukraine or Russia or Poland, depending on who didn't want to claim the Jews at that time of the war. And so there are foods that I eat, and there's a language of Yiddish that was my mama lashon. You know, like that's my culture. That's who I am. You know, being Jewish for me is not a religion. It's like my eyes are, you know, blue with, you know, like gold flecks in the middle, and I'm Jewish. Like that's just who I am. And my Judaism has, you know, really become a lot more, you know, progressive and expansive, just like our understanding of gender has become a lot more progressive and expansive. And I do talk about that in the book as well, both in the religion and the gender, you know, ways. So I think there's been like a general broadening of my understanding, but I feel very, you know, very comforted by a notion of like, I wake up every morning and like, that's amazing. That's a miracle to me. And, you know, I think we have the same faith if we believe we'll wake up tomorrow, and the way we celebrate it may be differently. But, you know, I think that like a lot of times atheists are more religiously fanatical about not believing in religion than I am about being religious. Like, usually the only people who say like, how do you reconcile science and religion are non-religious people, you know, like, well, I'm okay with it. Like, everybody's fine. Like, there's evolution and there's God. Like, everybody's fine with it on this side. I'm not atheist shaming. Like, I might be accused of that.
You mentioned when you started studying, you know, that you had this list of negative associations, which I'm curious about. We don't have to get into. But you mentioned gender and specifically that you have a strong feminist identity and gender roles being one of the, I think you mentioned, negative associations. And I'm curious, how, if you have advice for other people who are also trying to navigate the space between a strong religious conviction, which tends to put them in a place of more conservativism in life and community, alongside the strong feminist identity and belief system and values.
Well, I'm glad you saved this easy question for now. You know, I don't know that I have advice. I know what I've done, and it, you know, for the most part, it's worked for me. You know, I get angry a lot. I still get angry a lot. And there are organizations like the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance, JOFA, which I'm sure that there are many of you rolling your eyes like Orthodox feminism. But it actually is a thing, and there are women who advocate actively within the structure of Orthodoxy because it has value for them to fight for the rights of women and to fight for agunot, women who are chained in marriages because their husbands will not grant them a get. You know, the notions of gender equality or gender distinction in the prayer space, you know, is a very hot topic. Yeshivat Maharat, which is Rabbi Sarah Hurwitz, is an organization or a seminary that I support with my voice and with my pocketbook. Like, I'm a donor for that organization. We have several, we call them different things at different synagogues, but Los Angeles was the first Orthodox, had the first Orthodox synagogue to hire a female clergy person. Yeah, it's really amazing. It's B'nai David, and she's unbelievable. And, you know, a lot of my frustration fuels a lot of my passion. And when I was, you know, getting divorced and being granted my get and going through the process of speaking to rabbis,
what is a get for those who may not know?
In a traditional Jewish marriage, you have a civil, you know, a legal marriage document. And then there's also a ketubah, which is a written document, actually one of the first written documents historically to aim to protect women. A get guarantees that your husband, who many times when ketubahs were being written, oftentimes men would go away and study and travel, and the ketubah was supposed to protect a woman in case he didn't come back, in case when... She's still there, that 12-year-old. In case when he came back, he did not fulfill his husbandly duties. That was actually a reason that you could ask for a get. And a get is a written... It's emotional because I got one, and it's a very interesting process, a very interesting ritual. A get is a written document that's written by a scribe in front of a beis din, in front of a court of three, that releases you from your marriage. And it's a very powerful ceremony. I actually wrote an article about what that was like for me and Mike to do that. Anyway, so a lot of these issues are being tackled in particular by some of these female clergy members. And, you know, again, I know a lot of women, especially of an older generation, think like, well, that's not really a rabbi. But the fact is, what a lot of these Orthodox clergy women are doing is they are participating in activities that are not halachically restricted. There are customs in every community that are different, but the female rabbis within Orthodoxy are not signing documents, which is something we have not, you know, kind of figured out yet. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, why don't you just be a conservative female rabbi or reform? Because for a lot of women, and I'm one of them, there's a lot of beauty to the halachic structure and to observant Judaism. So again, I feel like we always have to function inside the patriarchy. We all are, men and women. And, you know, I do believe that there is strength in a lot of the traditional values of Judaism. As a person who happens to be very domestic and enjoys that, I like the rhythms of the Jewish calendar and sort of my prescribed role in a lot of ways. And I don't feel like that makes me a hypocrite or a contradiction. You know, people love to point out, like, well, if she's a feminist, why is she shaving her leg? Well, I don't shave my legs, but they say that about other people, right? And the fact is, like, because you don't get to make the rules about how any particular woman gets to exist. That's why. Like, like, that's, yeah, a lot of times I can be very, you know, I can seem like a contradiction, but that's just me in all of my entirety, and that's all of us, men and women too, you know?
You mentioned some egalitarianism in prayer, and I know your involvement with Women of the Wall.
Oh, right. I mean, I don't know that I have a particular involvement. I have spoken, you know, about some of the activism that they have done. Do you want me to talk more about that?
Yeah, we can talk.
Oh, no, I mean, it's... So I actually, you know, I don't... I'm just another person, you know? Like, I think, like, with certain things, people are like, well, what does Maya B. Alex say about Women of the Wall?
And just to just clarify that everyone understands what Women of the Wall is, do you want to give a brief...
Are you telling me that?
I'm asking you. Will you give a brief explanation?
Oh, so, I mean, correct me or fill in if I'm wrong. Women of the Wall is an organization that was originally started by a group of Orthodox Jewish women who wanted equal kind of prayer space and prayer rights at the Kotel in Jerusalem. And some of the complexity of this is that while many of us do support, you know, the right of women to have that, you know, there are many ways to go about trying to take down the patriarchy. And some of the ways that Women of the Wall in particular and other organizations have tried to enforce that has been very, very bold, which is good. But sometimes, you know, sometimes it's met with a lot of aggressive resistance, which I think fuels more publicity and less conversation. So I've actually been, I don't want to say critical, but I'm very, you know, I'm hesitant to try and shove things down the patriarchy's throat because often spoon feeding it, you know, and giving it a little bit more time and space, I think may be helpful. You know, for me in particular, and I wrote about this extensively, my father, Zichron Elivracha, passed away 2 years ago, and I recited Kaddish for him for a year, and I said Kaddish in many, many places, you know, wherever I went. I travel a lot, you know, for my work and in my life, and I would find a minyan pretty much. I mean, I found places to say Kaddish, you know, not only in Israel, but in Florida, in Savannah, Georgia, you know, up and down this state, all around New York. And, you know, I was saying Kaddish mostly in communities that had never had a woman say Kaddish before. And I will say I was never turned down. And I said Kaddish at some pretty strict Orthodox places. My local Orthodox synagogue, which is a right-wing Modern Orthodox shul, carved out a space for me And the community was really touched by my presence there. It was very complicated, but the role of women and women's prayer space became very clear because there was no space for me. And statistically speaking, women typically don't want to come to a morning minion at 5:30 in the morning because they're smart and they either stay in bed or take care of children or, I don't know, sleep, you know. But I was that woman, you know, who had to be, not who had to be, but who dragged myself out of bed.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features actress, writer, neuroscientist, and founder of GrokNation.com, Mayim Bialik, whose new book is Girling Up: How to Be Strong, Smart, and Spectacular. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at KALW.org.
There were places that I said Kaddish, which were horrendous in terms of, you know, how women were treated. You know, I've said Kaddish literally behind a wall. I've said Kaddish places where when I bowed, you know, like to say the Shemona Esrei, I would hit my head on, you know, a wall in front of me. It brought it home for me because I never wanted to not say Kaddish for my father. Never. And as angry as I would get and as painful as it was for me, I have to remember that I get to decide what my experience is, and I don't let to get those men. I don't allow those men to determine what my experience is with my God and the memory of my father. And I choose to function within a structure of Judaism that provided me a tremendous sense of comfort through the rituals that it encourages and that I chose to participate in. So, you know, my rabbi, Chaim Seidler Feller from UCLA, Hillel, you know, he taught all of us that you have to live with tension. You don't, you know, if you want a religion that has answers, there are many on the street corner that you can go to. We're a religion of questions, and there's a lot of tension in a religion that really supplies questions.
Thank you. We were talking about Jerusalem and the Wailing Wall, and another woman who is a self-identified feminist and Orthodox Jew, Ivanka Trump. And I
was like, no, she didn't. Oh, no, she didn't. Yes.
And I'm wondering what you might tell her. Do you have advice? I mean, do you think she would be open to listening to you? Presumably she grew up.
Is she here? Did you bring her?
No.
I mean, about what in particular?
Well, are there, you know, you've got a platform, and she's got a platform.
She's got platform shoes a lot of the time.
As do you. What are some, I mean, what are your, like, three, if you were able to sit down with Ivanka and offer her some, you know, can you get these issues in front of the world?
It's funny because Jordan and I spoke briefly, like, about what we were going to talk about, and I mentioned, like, oh, we'll talk about Ivanka Trump, and she was like, haha, that'd be fun, and here now
and
she
now
came
I'm
out with, like, a hardcore
question. And now I'm being hung out
question.
To dry.
You know, I don't envy her position, meaning that's an incredibly difficult place to be in, even as she was growing up. Like, the whole thing is, like, so, like you know, there's, like, such a bonkers aspect to what her life was like. No, just, like, growing up the way she did and, you know, being in the public eye like that. And I don't know her, and I don't know that I mean, of course there are things that I, you know, clearly believe that I would hope would be important to her. But honestly, I don't really know what role she's actually taking, and I get very sensitive and prickly around the discussion of the Kushners, as it were, because a lot of the Jewish conversation about it makes me really uncomfortable. You know, and I know that, like, in LA we're kind of in a bubble, in San Francisco we're kind of in a bubble, but I do know that there are many Jewish people you know, who really believe in voting for the Republican Party, sometimes for financial reasons and sometimes for Israel reasons. And, you know, I get that. But it really makes me nervous when, you know, like, oh, Jews will be okay because Kushner's in there. Like, that makes me feel really icky because I don't know that they always, you know, that that couple needs to speak for me or my Judaism, especially because of, you know, their alignment with a party that I don't feel is consistent with my Jewish values. So, thank you. So, you know, I'm gonna, you know, call on the amendment that allows me not to have to answer that specifically. But I will say that I think that my hope is that there will be a space. You know, if she is, you know, you know, an intelligent person who wants her intelligence kind of put out there. My hope had been that there would be a place for that, and wouldn't that be interesting? But it's been such chaos that there hasn't even been room for that. And it's interesting because Billy Bush just came out with a very interesting interview. So he was the one in that, you know, yeah, bus situation. And I was just on Access Hollywood yesterday for the book, and that's the show that he used to be on. And so it just had me thinking about it, and I read this article. And if you haven't seen this article or the interview with him, it's very interesting because, and you know, you can roll your eyes and say like it's just lip service, but he in this interview he talked about what it was like to get a phone call from his daughter, and that she called him right after the news broke. I don't know if she was 16, 17, and he thought that she was calling to be like, Dad, are you okay? So he said, you know, she got on the phone, she's like, Dad, what's going on? And he's like, everything's okay, honey. And she said, no, why did you laugh when he said that? I know. And he gave a really beautiful interview about what it's been like to come to a place of reckoning about what he was like and the things that went on in his mind and in our culture that led to that situation. And, you know, I still feel like I have this, like, pipe dream that things can, like, somehow, you know, straighten out so that we can have a place for, you know, Ivanka to stand up and be like, I fixed him, you know? I don't think that's going to happen, but I do think it's... I do think it's very interesting and significant that we have, you know, a modern Orthodox couple in that kind of position, because if nothing else, you know, it brings up a lot of questions. And I remember I once saw a picture of her and Jared when they had a baby. She was walking with a pram, like, in Manhattan. And, I mean, I think her outfits are typically, like, super awesome. Like, when she's going to shul, there's always, like, a weird hat with, like, a feather and a veil. And, you know, it's, like, very, very fancy. And they had a lulav, you know, over the top of the agala, the pram, stroller. Sorry, I'm like going to use every other dialect for stroller. And the headline was like, Jared buys Ivanka flowers on their stroll in New York. And it was like, I really wished I could have like taken a megaphone and been like, it's a lulav. It's a lulav.
And a lulav is a... Does everyone know what a lulav is?
It's for the holiday of Sukkot. It's like literally one of the weirdest things Jews do ritually. We take like myrtle and willow leaves and palm, and it sounds crazy. And we tie them together and we wave them all around.
It's a ritual.
Wait, I'm not done. And then we take a little... Then we take a citron fruit...
Which smells delicious.
And I call it an esrig, but in Hebrew etrog? They call it an etrog. We call it an esrig in Yiddish. So you take the citron. If no one's ever heard of this, you're going to be like, Jews are crazy. And you hold them together and you shake them pretty violently in all the directions. It's like one of the most pagan-y, non-pagan things we do.
And we celebrate Sukkot here at the JCC.
Do we?
You are all invited to come back in October.
And you can shake your lulav and your 12. Etrog.
I have a few rapid-fire questions I want to go through.
Rapid-fire questions.
Then we'll turn to audience questions.
Everyone's thinking, she doesn't know how to do rapid-fire. She's so talkative.
Your bat mitzvah theme?
My bat mitzvah theme was water, because my name means...
Water. All right. Favorite Jewish holiday?
Pesach. Passover.
Floaters or sinkers? Matzah balls. Passover's your favorite holiday.
Those terms didn't automatically make me think of matzah balls. so awkward right now. I don't know, Ma, did yours float? I think floating matzo balls is the
her
way to go.
Her answer was her mom's matzo balls, which
well,
we
no,
can all
because
agree
I'm,
is the
I'm vegan. It's very difficult to make a vegan matzo ball, but I've done it the last 2 years, and they definitely sink.
If you were to write fan fiction about Big Bang Theory, what would happen?
I don't really know what fan fiction is. Is that like where people make up stories and then they publish them on the internet? I don't know. I don't know. Something with Raj. I think he's a really funny character. I like the Raj and Stewart stuff. I'd probably have them get married.
Excellent. Terrific fan. I'm
Everyone's
sure it exists.
Kind of waiting for it, so yeah.
Yeah. Well, I want to leave lots of time for audience questions.
Okay.
So I'm thinking we should move towards that.
Hi. As another 41-year-old with anxiety problems and a PhD in engineering who doesn't use it, do you ever feel guilty for not using your degree to the fullest? Because I am working as a program manager now, and I am not working on DNA anymore, which maybe you can help my guilty conscience,
well,
I guess.
Well, I can help your guilty conscience by telling you that I feel... I don't know if guilty is the right word, but I feel that too. And I think especially as women, when we achieve things that historically women have not achieved, you know, there's this notion of like, why would you waste it by, and then fill in the blank. And I, you know, specifically was told, you know, why would you waste it by staying home with your children and not getting a postdoc? Like, that's like a thing that people said to me. I think there's two ways also to answer this. I don't feel like my degree is wasted because for me, like, that journey made me who I am. And the ability to make the decision to be, which for me was the right decision, it may not be the right decision for everyone, the decision for me to stay home with my children was only made because of all those years that I was in school and that I learned to appreciate my life and the universe and my place in it. And it's kind of like, you know, we're all the things we do and we're also all the things that we don't do. So, you know, for me, like, I wouldn't give up my training for anything. You know, literally formatting a thesis and doing a thesis before you could use the internet, what? was one of the most challenging things I've ever done. And, like, I've given birth to 2 children with no drugs. Like, I've done some hard things. Yeah, I'm like, I just want to talk about that a little more. I wrote a thesis, and many of us did, when you could not use the internet. I wouldn't give up those years and those struggles because it helped me make the decisions that I did. But I think also it should not be brushed aside that this is something that in particular for women tends to be something that we do consider and think about in different ways. And yes, men make decisions about starting families and all those things. But if you are a woman, and I know not every woman wants to have babies, and that's fine. If you are a woman who wants to have a baby and you'd like it to grow inside of your body and then come out of your body, you have a different set of considerations. And for me, those weighed very heavily. And, you know, I'm a scientist and I'm a mammal. And I, you know, fed and kept my children alive the way mammals have for all of mammalian history. And that connected me to my children physically in a way that really got in the way, it's true, of my career. And again, it's like living with that tension, you know? Yeah, sometimes I would look at like the 80th diaper in a day and say like, why is this what I'm doing? Like, I have a PhD. But, you know, I also, like, basically got the most advanced degree you can get is being a parent, and you get no training and no salary, and it's, like, the hardest, best job you'll ever have, you know? It's not for everyone, but it was for me. And, yeah, and you know, people love asking Mayim Bialik this question. When Big Bang's over, are you going to go back to being a PhD neuroscientist? It's like, no, my degree is worth, like, not much once you leave like that. And, you know, I look at my boys and I know that, like, for me, that's what it was. Like, for me, that was that decision. I was home with my children instead of teaching other people's children. And for me, it was the right decision. But, yeah, I'm resentful sometimes, for sure. My life could have been really different. I wouldn't have to wear makeup all the time, you know?
Hi. Do you see a separation between being a religious Jew and a cultural Jew? Because some people who you might define as being agnostic or not believing in religion at all, wanting to follow it, feel culturally Jewish and with no connection to the religion itself.
Yeah, this is actually really, I think this is, thank you. I think this is a great question. Yes, that's absolutely, you know, that's a distinction that not only do I personally believe in, but I think it's a very important one, and it highlights the complexity of Jewish identity, really. I remember, so my ex-husband is a convert, and he allows me to tell people that. A lot of converts, you know, sometimes don't want to be identified as that. But I remember, you know, one of the first meetings we had with our rabbi, who ended up, you know, doing his conversion and marrying us, and, you know, and Mike, you know, said, like, well, you know, I don't really know about this God thing. And the rabbi said, oh, you think that's going to stop anyone from wanting to convert you? Like, you know, welcome to the club. There are many Jews, you know, there are many Jews who struggle with the notion of God, the structure of religious practice, halacha. And the amazing thing about being Jewish is that your Jewish identity absolutely exists independent of your ritual practice, of your religious belief. And, you know, whenever people kind of disparagingly say, like, oh, you're just a religion like all others, why do you get a country? You know, which unfortunately, you know, people do still feel. You know, being Jewish, and, you know, I get a lot of harassment for this, but again, once people are like, well, she kind of studied it and she has a PhD, which I don't even know if that makes me a better authority on this, but, you know, what I've learned as a scientist, when you have a group of people who experience the genetic bottleneck that leads to diseases being prominent, that leads to the notion of a universal cultural identity, that's not, quote, just a religion, that's an ethnic identity, and your belief system and the structure of how you practice, thank you. Someone felt passionately about that. Your belief structure, how you practice, what you believe in, that's completely separate from your ethnic identity as a Jew. And, you know, when we think about the Muranos, you know, people who were forcibly converted, you know, from Judaism, you know, due to the Inquisition, what a show. Okay, sorry, some people old enough to know Mel Brooks. You know, those people are ethnically Jewish. They're part of the Jewish population. And I don't mean to argue for, like, a progressive Judaism of, like, you know, anyone who is part of the ethnic line, but it kind of is. And, you know, when we have a population, like, the genetic thing is a real thing. You know, you don't find that in Christian communities that you have Tay-Sachs and Gauchers and multiple sclerosis, you know, grouping with Crohn's disease and colitis, and all of the genetic things are really proof that we're a distinct ethnic and genetic population. And for that reason, I think it's really amazing, you know, to experience Jewish culture in places like New York, where a lot of non-Jews seem Jewish, right? But yeah, I think, you know, a lot of people in my family are absolutely culturally Jewish, have no really relationship to God or ritual, but have this sense of, like, a, you know, a Yiddish neshama, which sometimes is food related, sometimes it's music related, sometimes it's comedy related. And that's, you know, Woody Allen is a great example. And that is really, really powerful. And speaking of powerful, I really appreciate you all coming out. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was actress, writer, neuroscientist, and founder of GrokNation.com, Mayim Bialik, whose new book is Girling Up: How to Be Strong, Smart, and Spectacular. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.